This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Eva Clayton came to Warren County in the early 1960s, she had no idea that she would run for Congress and eventually become the first black woman North Carolina would send to the U.S. House of Representatives. Eva Clayton has dedicated her life to service, specifically organizing with the South's working class. She's also the founder of Eva Clayton Associates International, and she joins us today on the State of Things. Eva Clayton, also a member of WUNC's Community Advisory Board. Real pleasure to have you here, and thank you for your service to us as well.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You spent your early years in Augusta, Georgia, growing up. Tell us what it was like growing up in Savannah and Augusta, Georgia, in the 30s and 40s. What was it like?
Well, I was born in Savannah. My father was transferred to Augusta. He worked for an insurance company. And I grew up doing segregation time. Interesting, as I reflect now, in my I thought of my family and area as a poor area. In truth of it, although we were working class, but we weren't as poor as my parents would have me think I was. You know, we couldn't get this, couldn't get that. Mm-hmm. But and also, having grown up in a southern town and doing segregation, the block I lived on still had three white families. And two of them were merchants who were there to, you know, to live off the well, they had stores, and so the people in the neighborhood bought from them. Mm-hmm. The other one that lived next to us, either they were trapped there or didn't have a place to go, but they made more money than I think my father made, because they worked for the railroad. He did. He was a fireman. And I went to segregated schools, and my neighbors went to their segregated school. And I grew up in, I think, a supportive neighborhood where, you know, the families looked out for each other. And our family actually looked out for the white family that was next door. But my mother would never allow me to go there unless she was home. I went in the house if my mother was home and the mother was there. I don't know why. I think I know now.
Why do you think that?
My mother was trying to protect me as a girl. I think my mother was trying to protect me as a black. If something was missing, or I would be taken advantage of. I never asked her. You know, it's reflective. And also, my mother never borrowed anything from her. But they borrowed from us. It was free. In fact, the kids sometimes, the mother was sometimes the person who would come home late, and she didn't mind asking. She called my mother Josephine. She said, you know, I'm going to be late, Josephine. And my mother said, oh, no problem. Woody and Ann can stay over here. Sometimes they stay over to 9 o'clock. Come pick them up. We would study together, but never ever did I ever study with them.
Interesting now to think back on all of that, the way you had to put together those puzzles, those unanswered riddles about why we treat white people this way or why they can come here and we don't go there.
That's
as
right.
You kind of grow up, coming up with, essentially had to come up, I guess, with your own answers to what.
Well, that, you know, I can't imagine my mother was peculiar, you know. and not only she's peculiar in that way, she's peculiar in other ways too. And also, mother was protective.
Sure.
Protective not only of me as a girl, but my brother, and wanted the very best for us, you know, the very best for us.
Father did too. He worked for an insurance company, and talk about that. It's an important insurance company down there.
Yeah, it's long existing, but it's very important. During that time, blacks weren't insured by the major insurance company. They were only insured by black insurance company. He worked for this company that was home office in Savannah. That's how I was born in Savannah. And it was called the Guarantee Life Insurance Company. And my father at one time was what they call the state agency director. Later in his life, he became the manager for Augusta, Georgia. And we were moved to Augusta. And I moved from Savannah to Augusta at about age 5. And he had a district, and I guess there were about 6 or 7 agencies in this that worked out of the Augusta, Georgia office, went to small towns around Augusta. And what they do is knock on the doors and collect insurance. And my brother and I said my father could sell a tombstone insurance. You know, you could be already dead, and he was selling insurance. He was a great salesman. He was. My mother, on the other hand, was very strict, and my father was a gentleman of the ultimate. He would lift his hat, and it was just he was Mr. Protocol. My mother, although very particular, was, you know, a very practical person, worked hard. She started out teaching. She was a teacher before she married my father, about 5 years. But I knew her as a seamstress. She sewed, very talented. And later in her life, she became the director of an orphanage that was not too far from our home. In the community I lived in, my brother and I said we lived on the poor side of the college community. Payne College was not that far from us. It was a Methodist school for blacks. There were two. My brother and I were the kids and by my mother and father. My father had been married before, and I had a half-brother who was much older. And he didn't live in our home. He lived at the original home in Savannah. He was an electrician. I'm the first to graduate from college in my family.
And you decided you wanted to be a doctor.
I did. I went early in my life. Early in my life, I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a doctor missionary. I wanted to be a doctor. I thought one of my best friends had polio, and I told her I was going to be a doctor and was going to heal her. Now, you have to be arrogant to think that you're going to be able to do that, obviously. But I think, you know, you want to be able to fix what's wrong with your best friend.
A little arrogant and a little compassionate.
And a little compassionate.
All right.
I will confess. It was a desire to help. Yeah. It was a desire to help.
And a missionary. So you thought that, I mean, you saw yourself kind of living this exotic life abroad somewhere.
Right. Have you ever heard of Albert Schweitzer?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
Believe it or not, I thought I could be the black female Albert Schweitzer. Well, so much for that, right? I wanted to be a doctor missionary. He was a musician. Now, I never thought I could be a musician, although my mother tried and tried, and I took piano lessons. But Albert Schweitzer was both a medical doctor, a musician, and he was also a theologian. And I thought I could go to Africa and do whatever missionaries do and be both in the medical field but also in the theological field. Yeah. So when I went to college thinking I was going to go to med school.
And so what brought you to North Carolina then?
I met a husband. He brought me to North Carolina. I met a North Carolina. That's what happened. So that's how I got to North Carolina.
Went to college here?
Yes. The college was in Charlotte. It's a small Presbyterian college called Johnson C. Smith University. And as a freshman, I met Theocious T. Clayton, who was a senior. And when he came back from the military, I guess I was still waiting. I talked to other people, you know, between times. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, I married him. He promised me that he wanted to go to law school, and I wanted to go to med school, and we still had those kind of aspirations. But we came up with a time when the female kind of deferred to the husband's ambition first. You know, that's my mother. You know, I came from a family that kind of did that traditionally. Mm-hmm. So I started teaching while he went to law school with the idea that I would get a master's, and I did get the master's. Never go to medical school. Though. Mm-hmm. He promised that we would go back to Charlotte, and he would open a practice. Never ever thought I would end up in a very rural area. I
mean, Warren County,
yes.
Warren County, up in the northeastern part of the state.
Lovely place.
What did bring you there? What
my husband.
You? And what? And so that was his.
Well, that's he had an opportunity there,
yeah.
And when he. Finished law school. Actually, his first opportunity to practice was with someone by the name of Floyd McKissick.
Oh, yes.
Which re-enters his life a little later. And so he practiced with him, I guess, about 6 months. And the dean of the law school approached my husband about an offer or inquiry that had come to the school about an African-American wanting to enter in partnership with a white lawyer. And the dean had inquired of my husband if he would be interested, and he had referred my husband to the person. And so this was James Gillen, a white lawyer from Warren County, who wanted to organize an integrated law firm.
Wow. What was behind that? Because at this time, and that's not a part of the state that we associate with the most progressive part of the state, certainly.
Well, he was a maverick, and he was daring, and I think he wanted to show the powers be he could do what he wanted to do.
Now, your husband had to be a little daring to enter into that partnership. What was
he
thinking?
He was thinking he was making history.
Yeah.
We talked it over, and it was an opportunity. And actually went there thinking he would do it for 3 to 5 years. And the more you realize that this is an area that needed a lawyer and needed a black lawyer and the sense of pride that people had. Now, obviously, there were times when blacks would look at my husband, look at the white lawyer in the same office and said, you know, I like you, but I'm going to go to the other guy. My husband has a lot of stories like that. But, you know, it was a time of growth. And it was a time of maturity. So my husband eventually got more engaged in civil rights. And that's how I got engaged.
You did indeed. And we will talk more about that because you weren't just the wife behind the scenes once you got to Warren County,
right.
A place that needed a lot of things, including a desegregated law firm. We'll talk more about Eva Clayton's role in Warren County and the rest of the state as our conversation with Eva Clayton continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking with Eva Clayton, former congresswoman and the founder of Eva Clayton Associates International. And we got you to Warren County. Your husband joins a white law partner there, Warren County, North Carolina. This is in the mid-60s, right?
Right.
So talk about the county there and its needs. You said that, you know, he understood he might be making history. That county had some needs. What were they and how was life in Warren County at the time?
Well, the people are fantastic. The people were very embracing. Obviously, there was some resistance in the white community about this integrated law firm. But eventually, even the law practice, I mean, the legal community began to accept it. Now, that did not overcome the fact that both the education and the economic conditions of Warren County, and it was a struggle. In fact, today it's still a struggle, like many counties in rural North Carolina, rural America. But Warren County demographically is about half and half. It also has a small percentage of the Indian community called the Halawa. So the minority demographic is high in Warren County. The poverty level is also high in Warren County. The effort to try to find jobs, of try to encourage people, you had the out-migration of younger people, so you have an older population. And so you found yourself in a community that needed to have encouragement that they could get jobs or you could bring them together to start exercising their civil rights. And part of what we found in Warren County is because things were so hard, both economically or socially, people didn't get involved in civil rights. They got involved in going to PTA meetings or going to church, but far as the elective position, everything was controlled by whites, rather the school board or county commission or city council, as well as representative state and federal level. So all of that was white.
Of course, mid-60s, the Voting Rights Act doesn't get passed until 1965. And
that's
so
true.
Then there were other barriers as
that's
well.
True. That's true.
And this
true.
Is where you got involved. Tell us about your activism in terms of trying to turn out the black vote.
Well, I got involved. It could have been more by accident, but I got involved both in civic activity. But the specific opportunity that came to citizen and then what we call the second congressional district was as a result of the Voters' Rights Act. The Voter Education Project was interested in encouraging leaders throughout the South to put themselves forward as an elective candidate. And my husband and others were invited. I went along. So that's why I say it might have been by accident. And there were about 20 people, and I'm not sure you are familiar with the person by the name of Vernon Joyner, but he's a kind of famous civil rights person,
mm-hmm,
still lives today, and he's still active. And he was then the head of the Voter Education Project of the Southern Region Council. And out of that were a number of congressional districts throughout the South. And in the second congressional district, leaders were invited that someone should run. And there were about three other women, but out of the 20, I bet 17 of them were men. No one raised a hand, and I raised my hand. Maybe I was, you know, the dumb one in the crowd. I'm not sure what it was, but anyhow, I raised my hand and said, if no one else will do, I'll do it. So I volunteered. No one asked me. I volunteered to say Eva Clayton would run for Congress in 1968. Well, needless to say, that effort, though enthusiastic and brought people together and all of that, I lost royally. There are counts that I had 32%, another count that I had 41%. But anyhow, for sure, I lost. But in terms of getting people to see the opportunity and to rally, it was a phenomenal success. Encouraging people to take ownership of their right to go down there and register, or register their grandparents, or register their mother, or them register themselves, was just so inspiring to see. Not only that, during this process, there were others who ran through the state, and Reginald Hawkins ran for governor. Reginald Hawkins and Martin Luther King were personal friends, and they decided, Reginald decided that the major campaign effort he would invite his friend, personal friend, to was in my district. One, because the whole district had a large percentage of the population being Afro-American. And so in Rocky Mount, we scheduled a rally for Martin Luther King to come and to inspire the community. He died the week before. He was killed the week before. And not only how he died and why he died, that even just, not only it frightened people, but it gave people greater depth of understanding. Those who were still on the sidelines came out and wanted to be engaged in it. We would have never had as many people at the rally if he had come. Actually, Abernathy came for that. And I think that was either the second event he did beyond the funeral. Mm-hmm. And the idea that he had died had given his life. He didn't want to be killed, but he put himself in a position that it was so important that all of us could vote. We had the right to vote. That inspired people. So the inspiration, the event, all of that was a phenomenal experience for all of us.
What was it doing for you as a candidate? I mean, you can imagine this event working two ways on the mind of particularly black voters. On the one hand, inspiring you to get more involved, now's the time. On the other hand, it's frightening. It's like, wait a minute, they're coming after us.
Well, it was frightening, but it was also reassuring. Frightening in the sense that your life was vulnerable. Frightening in the sense that Martin had given his life, but reassuring that this was very, very important. Very, very important. If you had any doubt, Eva Clayton, that this was important, it was important. So, it was so important that it recommitted myself, not just myself, everybody who was involved in that were recommitted. And I don't think it's just the second congressional district of North Carolina. I actually think it was the nation. I mean, sure. His death just profoundly affected people in very significant ways.
Take us back to that moment when you decided to raise your hand. Did you go to that meeting with the intention of volunteering?
Absolutely not.
So it's in that moment.
Absolutely not. It's in the moment. It's the moment. I mean, you know, I'm not sure what raised my hand, but I raised my hand. No one told me. Oh, no one said, Eva Clayton, you may be interested. There was no hint of Eva Clayton in. I don't even think the word she, although there were three, I think, other women there. It was in the mind that a she or her could run. It was in the mind. I think there were three lawyers, my husband, one for Rocky Mount, and I'm not sure where the other one, Greenville. And there were some doctors and business people, and they had invited leaders or people they thought could afford to run.
Did did you, what was, once you finally made that decision, were you thinking, well, I may not win, but at least I'll rally voters? Or did you imagine yourself winning and going to Congress? I mean, what was going through your mind after you decided?
Well, I thought, I didn't feel confident that I would win. I did feel confident that I would get very close. I felt confident I would get closer than I did. And I also thought I would be the inspiration for other people to do something. Yeah. I saw myself being a motivator. On my way home, I said to my husband, why didn't you run? They really wanted you to run. Why didn't you run? He looked at me and said, well, now who would take care of these four children? I mean, I think he was being practical. I wasn't working. I was a housewife, so I could give the time, you know. But I guess I wasn't thinking of a cost, you know. And I think he and others might have been thinking of how their practice, whether they were doctors or lawyers or whatever, how could it afford to be away from their business?
It's interesting that you had to defer your plan to become a doctor, in a sense, because of a traditional woman's role. And then, on the other hand, that same tradition, that same sort of cultural expectation thrust you into the limelight, and now you're running for Congress.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. The fact that I was a wife and available. And also, I think, you know, back to wanting to make a difference as a possible doctor is what motivated me to say, oh, I'll do that, you know. And, you know, I'm not without some, you know, confidence or ego think that I can make a difference. So I think it was the moment that I thought, hey, this is an opportunity for me to stand up, to make that difference.
And also important to think about the fact that the Voting Rights Act is passed. It's a great moment in American history. And yet in 1965, a kind of empty promise, the right to vote, if the candidates themselves don't reflect the population that they're representing. And so to actually get people motivated to vote.
Absolutely.
Things really have to change beyond just the legislation.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only the law is on the book, but we who wanted the law have to exercise to test that out. Another part of that testing out where I wasn't as courageous was during my college days in the summer. Again, I told you my mother was rather strict. My father was mostly. During the college, I wanted to work in the North. Many of my college friends went North and made money. My mother wouldn't allow me to go unless there was under some organization. Again, for the same reason she didn't allow me to go next door, right? But anyhow, the organization that I accidentally, and a lot of things have happened in my life accidentally and have made a difference. The organization that came, I was part of the student council, that came to the student council and asked for students, and I volunteered, was a group called the American Friends Service Committee, the Quaker group. So I had the opportunity to work in with them during the summer and would come home on the bus. In 1956, I believe, the interstate travel came through saying that part of the nation where you could ride the bus integrated. So my friend, Jewish friend, myself, had worked in Chicago, and we were coming home. And so, you know, Eva and Bernice were going to test the slow out. But I called my mother and said, I wanted to know in case I got in jail. You know, just, you know, I wanted to just warn somebody that I was going to do that. And you can imagine, this is the same woman. She said, I hope you know what you're doing. And I expect for you not to go to jail. I hope you conduct. But anyhow, she didn't say no, but she let me know that I shouldn't be testing it. In Indiana, we got to Indiana, and the bus driver said to us, now, I want you to know you're about to enter the South. And if you do, you have no protection. And I warn you to go, talking to Eva, not Bernice, I warn you to go back in the bus. Well, I must say, I wasn't as brave as I was when 1968. I didn't raise my hand. I did go back of two seats. Bernice went back in front of us. She was in the seat in front, and I was in the seat back. And so the bus driver again approached her. She said, I understand what you all are doing. You are working, and they said that, told Bernice, you holding these people up because they can't sit behind you. And Bernice said, well, they can sit with me. And they said, no, Eva, you should move. Bernice said, no, she doesn't move. I didn't move. Bernice moved up. And both of us kind of less than, we feel less that we didn't stand up as we should have. But that was my first test of that.
Well, I'm glad you told that story, because I think too often when we hear the stories of the heroes of any movement, but let's say the civil rights movement, they come to us kind of full-blown saints, and we never know about these moments of truth where maybe they demurred and where this moment of courage didn't come to them. But understand, we're human beings who have a flaw. Not a flawed moment. This is a real good worry that you had. This is a real solid fear.
Yes.
But it had to become, and I'll ask you about this.
I was 17. I was 18.
Yeah. And you've got your mother's warning.
Don't get in jail.
I'm imagining that finger in the air.
You absolutely. She did have a long finger. You got that right. She had a long finger.
But this moment then has to, does it not come with you? At some point, this memory stays with you. And when in the middle of nowhere, without any expectation or warning, someone says, we need somebody to run, to what extent does that memory motivate that hand to go in the air? I mean, you know.
Well, it could. I must say, I was more courageous then than I was. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm saying that. And it probably did wear on my conscience that if I ever have an opportunity to test the law again, I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. And because I really didn't go there to run. It was more accident.
Yeah.
And I would have been very happy to support someone else.
You didn't win that race. We'll talk about when you did in the 1990s, the 1992 election. But what happened after that election of 68?
Well, as a
Well,
as a result of that, I guess I came to the attention of other people and the University of North Carolina. I asked if I head up a program they had, and it was North Carolina Health Manpower. At least that's what it's called now. And the idea was through the med school, they were interested in increasing the number of doctors, the dentists, and other health professionals. So it was a collaboration between the University of North Carolina and other schools, and what they call minorities at that time, included also those who were dislocated or either in rural areas. Western Carolina was considered because of the remoteness of it.
Yeah.
Pembroke was also a part of it because of the Indian. And then you had historical Black College, North Carolina Central, and you had also Elizabeth City. And they would have feeder schools, and it was a summer program and an enrichment program, and we would help them with tests. And as a result, we really did increase the number of blacks going into medicine and dentistry and public health as well as nursing. So we did that for 2 years.
And then you entered into a partnership with Floyd McKissick, who you said was part of the reason your husband went to Warren County, Floyd McKissick Sr., and developed a project, a housing development called Soul City. Tell us about that.
Well, Floyd McKissick, who then had been the headed up CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, as he had been a lawyer who early in his life, my husband worked with him when he was in Durham, but he'd gone to be a national figure. And he'd come to the conclusion that one opportunity for minority as well as for rural areas is to create what they call a new town development. And actually he was trying to model that program very much like a Columbia, Maryland. Columbia, Maryland was a new town. And he wanted to be the first to do one in rural areas where you didn't just tap onto the outgrowth of a Raleigh, outgrowth of a Charlotte. But you were in a brand new rural area trying to create. And obviously you need housing, but before you need housing, you need water, you need streets and those kinds. And initially he gotten some funds to do the house. I was brought on to do the social programs. I was serving as the executive director of the Soul City Foundation, and we were responsible for getting some housing and making it affordable in those areas. We also were responsible for bringing the health program and social program. We started the first rural health clinic in there. And because I had had the prior opportunity to work at UNC Med School, it gave me some access to medical professionals who didn't mind helping me to design the program. And so we had opportunity to put those programs into place. Now, Soul City never materialized, the federal government with health of funds. There was a strong political opposition in the form of Senator Jesse Helm, and he made sure that it didn't get any additional funds. So, and Floyd actually tried to do it without federal funds, but it was impossible to do. And it's well developed, but very few houses there. As a result of the Soul City project being developed, the state was to provide more resources. I became county commissioner during a period of time, and we now have a state prison. Now, I don't want to say state prison came as a result of Soul City, but in the process of developing Soul City, there was a regional water system that benefited not just Warren County, but what we call Region K. And part of the strategy for the initiation of this project was to get federal funds to complement the state funds. And in that process, the state also provided institution. The institution happened to be the state prison.
And we'll talk more about that, the development of Warren County and the political career of Eva Clayton on The State of Things. Our conversation continues after this break. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Eva Clayton today, former congresswoman, founder of Eva Clayton Associates International. So we're talking about Soul City and its failure to flourish in large part because the federal funding never followed. What were some of the other lessons learned from that whole project?
Well, some of the lessons learned, I hope we can unlearn. One is that if you don't have the political support, they can really put a stumbling block. And Jesse Helm was determined to close, and he did. The lesson learned is that you need to try to persuade people. And also, unfortunately, the word soul just was misinterpreted. Floyd did a good job trying to make sure the people didn't misunderstand. It wasn't all black town. In fact, Floyd came down with three of his white friends that helped him, and there were more white investors who were involved than there were black investors, but the word soul just took away the opportunity to see this as anything other than a black town. So I guess the lesson learned is that sometimes you can't be as artful as you want to be. I think that needs still to be unlearned, but it's the truth of that situation. The other one is still one that's more troubling, is what can we do in rural areas that make that difference? Even now, if you begin to look at the shift in the demographics and the population in North Carolina, you begin to see it move from rural areas to the urban areas. Is there no way we can stimulate growth in that part of our state or that part of our nation? I think it still begs a question. How can we make a difference in rural communities where we don't have the infrastructure?
And it's one you had to think about as a Warren County commissioner. Tell us about that and running for office there, winning that election, and serving on the county commission.
Well, we did, and we were very pleased to do that. In fact, as a result of that, there was a lot of investment that we did. I think the fact that we finished the infrastructure for the regional water system was on my clock. We expanded the health clinic that was at Soul City to make it larger for all Warren County. There were some disappointments during my time. I tell people, unfortunately, I had to be the one to announce that we had to close the hospital. I mean, here, Eva Clayton had worked at the university, adding more minorities to the whole health area, and she, as the county commissioner chair, had to announce that given the condition of the hospital, it needed to be closed, both not only because of the fiscal cost, but also because of the quality. We just didn't have the funds, and I was very pleased to be engaged at the rural level in development. I was fortunate to be recognized not only by my state but also nationwide as being engaged. I served on the National Board of County Commissioners. So I not only saw the need of my own county but also was involved nationwide in terms of development. And I think that prepared me for other political areas as I went further. In North Carolina, I was pleased to be elected the county commissioner of the year. I mean, all the county commissioners themselves did that. And I think it was because I had the opportunity to see how we try to bring development for rural areas. Now, that's not to say that it was sufficient right. for all things, but it's to say as when we started is where we ended.
Right, and it was also a chance for you to make another run at Congress, and this time in 92 you won. Tell us about that and how you came to be a candidate. And
well, in 92, our then existing congressperson had announced he was going to retire. And so it gave an opportunity to – and also we had the demographics from the last census, which – and had redistricting. Which there were two districts in North Carolina, both the second at that time as well as – and the first as well as the 12th. And so in – at our district, I think it was those who were registered about 48%. It might have been a little less than that. But the demographics showed the possibility of 50% if they all registered because they never did. But – and – so a number of minorities were encouraged to run. I was asked by persons who knew I had run before. Now, I had to want to run. Obviously, I wouldn't have run. But I did run, and I won. Unfortunately, the incumbent died before the end of his term. I also ran to secede him. So I went in, I guess, about 2 months earlier than it. I served on the Agriculture Committee. I had said earlier I was from Augusta, Georgia, so I knew very little about farming other than I married a farmer, but he became a lawyer, so I mean, what did I know about farming? And I was in a rural area. But it was then a commission called Jim Graham who said to me, you know, you do yourself well if you would serve on the Agriculture Committee. I thought about that because I was more interested having my experience with the Soul City Project and urban air. I was more interested in human and health or in housing. But I reflected on the district I was representing. It was a very rural district, and agriculture was one of the staples of that district. So I served in agriculture. I'm delighted I did. I learned an awful lot about agriculture. Got to meet an awful lot of good folks. Having gone to Congress, when a lot of women went there, I was fortunate to be elected as the president of my freshman class. Served, and that gave me access to represent them with the White House. And so there were a number of issues that I was called on. Agriculture was something I was learning. Served on the Nutrition and the Operation Committee. Became the ranking committee. Member on a number of those committees. I was very much engaged in writing the farm bill. Farm bill is written every 5 years.
Yeah.
And the last one that we wrote was the one that we made sure that the expansion of food stamps, expansion of nutrition programs were there. At the time there, those persons who were Hispanic or those persons who were immigrants weren't able to get food stamps if they were, even if they were working and showed.
Yeah.
So that the provision, the exception was made so they could. Also, the whole issue of the black farmers issue was one where black farmers prior to my coming really had been discriminated against by the Department of Agriculture, where they had not allowed them to get programs that they were eligible for or to make loans. And they made the application. They were always turned down. We were able to extend what we call the statute of limitation had closed their opportunity to make a lawsuit. We were able to open that up and allow them to make the claim again. Many of them did. In fact, they have reopened that again so they can do it. So the case Pitfoot against the U.S. Department of Agriculture is a very famous case. We were able to make that happen. So we were very pleased to have opened the doors legally so they can make that part.
What was it like for you? You mentioned the fact that in 92 there were not a lot of women in Congress. In fact, you were the first woman who the state of North Carolina sent to the House of Representatives and certainly the first black woman to serve in the House for the state. What was it like for you working in that environment? Clearly you had some success.
Well, it was a unique experience. Also, 92 was the year of the woman in Congress. A lot of women came, not from North Carolina. As you indicated, I was the first woman and the first African-American woman. But a lot of women came to Congress that year. Otherwise, I would have been elected the president of that class. But it was an experience for me to work with the men who were in my delegation, and also to work, although at that time Jesse Helms was there. We've had, you know, in spite of our differences and strong differences, not only in policy, but personal differences in how he treats Soul City, we had to learn how to work with him too. So you have to learn with people you oppose as well as people in other party. And interesting, we were able to intercede with him to make sure that he did. And there were some things we worked together.
So intercede with him to make sure what?
Well, on one issue was he was denying a person the opportunity to be the Assistant Secretary for Commerce. That person, I did not know, but that person had a relative in North Carolina. And she knew that perhaps I could talk with Jesse Helms. Actually, I hadn't talked with Jesse Helms, but she thought I could. And as a result of her needing someone to intercede for her, I decided to go over and talk with her. And she became the Assistant Secretary of Commerce. You know, the senators can put a hold on your nomination. And he has successfully blocked her going forward. Mm. He had put a hold on for a reason he thought was valid, but there was no valid reason. And he indicated that it was a reason about her husband. Listen, I said, if we were determined by all our relatives, none of us would get too far. And I suggested to him, I bet he had some people in his family that you know, didn't do all the things he wanted. As a result of that, we were able to, in fact, I approached him about the whole piece of the black farmer. Now, he wasn't very helpful on that, but I tell you what, he didn't interfere with it. Sometimes if you can get your opposition just to stay quiet, you know,
that's a victory.
Hey, yeah, absolutely.
Especially when you have the power that he had accumulated by that time, by the 1990s. He'd been there 20 years. And,
absolutely.
And he had a lot of power in
absolutely.
That.
But it was a good experience for me. And as a result of that, I was able to do some other things. Learning agriculture internationally was an opportunity for me as well.
You, speaking of that, began working with the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Tell us about that work.
Well, once I decided to retire, and, you know,
after five terms, by the way, is that right?
After 10 years, right.
Yeah.
Five terms.
Yeah.
You run every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had said during my campaign that I would run for 8 to 10 years. I don't know why I said that, but I said. And I said, I also conditioned it that if I was having fun and making a contribution, I thought, you know, you should do things that you're enjoying. And you should do things that you think you're making a contribution. Well, 10 years passed, and I was still having fun, and I'm still making a contribution. But I thought that I should keep my word about that. Not knowing exactly that I would have this opportunity. But I was allowed to represent the United States Agriculture Department going to the World Food Conference in Rome, Italy. And while there, I was apprised that the American who was Assistant Director General would soon retire. The director of the FAO is the largest organization of the United Nations. It is the Food Agriculture Organization. It has representatives all over. In fact, we have an ambassador there. The ambassador there informed me that this position was available. He also informed the Director General that I had retired. And so the Director General came to me in the United States when I got back and told me all the opportunities this will allow me to further what I was doing in Congress about agriculture development. And he knew I had interests around the poor. He knew I had interests around hunger. So it allowed me to kind of, the commitment and compassion I had allowed me to put it in. So what I did while there was to try to organize partnerships and alliances around the world to reduce hunger in half by 2015. So we started a number of alliances. That's what we call them there. And these alliances were made up of governments, is made up of religious organizations, made up of a private organization and civil organization. The International Alliance in Rome was made up of the four Rome-based agriculture. And that would include FAO, World Food Program, and EFAD in the biotech.
So you see, Eva, there you are. You encourage minority recruitment for UNC in the medical schools, mm-hmm. and then you do World Hunger, and so now you are a doctor and a missionary,
right.
as well as all the other things. You've got it all done. But I wonder what you think now as you look at efforts to suppress the vote, efforts to make voting harder after your long work in encouraging the vote, how you think it's going these days, and what's your take on some of these efforts?
Well, it's very discouraging, very discouraging. And it's also frightening to see the progress go back. But hopefully, just as I was inspired at the time that Martin was assassinated and other people were inspired that we would not allow that to happen, I think the resistance to this kind of retrogressing is so strong that people will not allow. Now, that's not to say we will not see laws on the book. That just in North Carolina alone, they have also acted that. But what that will spur, I think, will be greater participation, not less. If you notice those long lines during this last election, when they made it difficult in Florida and other places to vote, people stood in line 3 and 4 hours to vote. In fact, the election had been called and people were still exercising their right to vote. I think when you try to take something away from people, even those who have been cavalier or disregarding their rights or really just downright lazy, something inspires them to say, no, that will not happen. I am discouraged, but I'm also defiant that many people will unite and not allow that to happen.
One of the things that's been taken away, and I'm going to allow you only about 30 seconds for this, but jobs, you talked about rural development. Jobs don't come. The corporations aren't investing in rural areas. Are there alternatives? Are there other lessons from Soul City? The idea of grassroots worker ownership, people developing their own businesses and grassroots development that allows for ownership rather than simply jobs in those rural areas. Any hope for that kind of idea?
I think there is. I think perhaps the Soul City project, although I would like to see it go, is a little too ambitious as a big. But I think some components of that are cooperatives around agriculture, around opportunities that are germane and significant to rural areas where the urban areas can benefit as well. I think that'll work.
Eva, what a great pleasure talking with you.
Oh, my pleasure as well. Thank you.
Eva Clayton, former Congresswoman, the founder of Eva Clayton Associates International, my guest today, and also a WUNC Community Advisory Board member. Thanks for listening to our show. We're at stateofthings.org. Our program is directed by Alex Granados, produced by Isaac Davey Aronson, Sean Wen, and Nicole Campbell. Christina Blides, the intern. Robin Copley, our technical director. Brent Wolf, our news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.